conferences.
Really? What does she speak on?
She helps people think through their relationship with God in the face of their own death.
I'd love to hear more about that, encouraged Jesse as he stirred up the fire with a stick, causing it to bloom with renewed vigor.
Mac hesitated. As much as he felt unusually at ease with these two, he didn't really know them, and the conversation had gotten a little deeper than he was comfortable with. He searched quickly for a short answer to Jesse's interest.
Nan's a lot better at that than I am. I guess she thinks about God differently than most folks. She even calls him Papa because of the closeness of their relationship, if that makes sense.
Of course it does.
Jesse nodded.
Is that a family thing, referring to God as Papa?
No, the kids picked it up some, but I'm not comfortable with it. It just seems a little too familiar for me. Anyway, Nan has a wonderful father, so I think it's just easier for her.
It had slipped out, and Mac inwardly shuddered, hoping no one had noticed, but Jesse was looking right at him.
Your dad wasn't too wonderful.
Yeah. I guess you could say he was not too wonderful. He died when I was just a kid, of natural causes.
Mac laughed, but the sound was empty. He looked at the two.
He drank himself to death.
We're so sorry.
Sarah said it for both of them, and Mac could sense that she meant it.
Well, life is hard sometimes, but I've a lot to be thankful for.
An awkward silence followed, as Mac wondered what it was about these two that seemed to penetrate his defenses so easily. He was rescued seconds later by a flurry of children as they poured out of the trailer and into their midst. Much to Kate's glee, she and Emmy had caught Josh and Amber holding hands in the dark, and now she wanted the whole world to know. By this time, Josh was so smitten that he was willing to put up with any harassment and took what she dished out in stride. He couldn't have wiped the silly grin off his face, even if he had tried. Both Madisons hugged Mac and his children goodnight, with Sarah giving him an especially tender squeeze before she left. Then, hand in hand with Amber and Emmy, they headed off into the darkness toward the Doucette site. Mac watched them until he could no longer hear their night whispers, and the swaying of their flashlight disappeared from sight. He smiled to himself, and turned to herd his own brood in the direction of their sleeping bags. Prayers were said all around, followed by goodnight kisses and giggles from Kate in low conversation with her older brother, who would occasionally burst out in a harsh whisper so everyone could hear,
"Cut it out, Kate! Ow! I mean it! You are such a brat!"
And eventually, silence. Mac packed up what he could by the light of the lanterns and soon decided to leave the rest till daylight. They weren't planning to leave until early afternoon anyway. He brewed his final nightly cup of coffee and sat sipping it in front of the fire that had burned itself down to a flickering mass of red-hot coals. It was so easy to get lost inside such a bed of glowing, undulating embers. He was alone. Yet, not alone. Wasn't that a line from the Bruce Coburn song, Rumors of Glory? He wasn't sure, but if he remembered, he would look it up when he got home. As he sat mesmerized by the fire and wrapped in its warmth, he prayed, mostly prayers of thanksgiving. He had been given so much. Blessed was probably the right word. He was content, at rest, and full of peace. Mac did not know it then, but within 24 hours his prayers would change drastically. The next morning, though sunny and warm, didn't start off so well. Mac rose early to surprise the kids with a wonderful breakfast, but burned two fingers while trying to free flapjacks that had stuck to the griddle. In response to the searing pain, he knocked over the stove and griddle and dropped the bowl of pancake batter onto the sandy ground. The kids, startled awake by the clatter and under-the-breath expletives, had stuck their heads out of the tent trailer to see what all the commotion was about. They began to giggle as soon as they grasped the situation. But one, "Hey, it's not funny," from Mac, and they ducked back into the safety of the tent, still tittering from their hideout while they watched through the mesh windows. So breakfast, instead of the feast Mac had intended, was cold cereal with half and half, since the last of the milk had gone into the pancake batter. Max spent the next hour trying to organize the sight with two fingers stuck in a glass of ice water, which had to be refreshed frequently with chips that Josh broke off the ice block with the backside of a spoon. Word must have gotten out, because Sarah Madison showed up with burn first aid, and within minutes of having his fingers slathered in the whitish liquid, he felt the sting recede. About that time, Josh and Kate, having completed their ordered chores, showed up to ask if they could go out in the Doucette's canoe one last time, promising to wear life jackets. After the initial mandatory no and the required amount of begging from the kids, especially Kate, Mac finally gave in, reminding them once again of the rules of canoe safety and conduct. He wasn't too concerned. Their campsite was only a stone's throw from the lake, and they promised to stay close into shore. Mac would be able to keep an eye on them while he continued packing up the camp. Missy was busy at the table, coloring in the book from Multnomah Falls. "She's just too cute," Mac thought, glancing in her direction as he worked to clean up the mess he had made earlier. She was dressed in the only clean thing she had left, a little red sundress with embroidered wildflowers, a Joseph purchase from their first day's trip into town. About 15 minutes later, Mac looked up when he heard a familiar voice calling, "Daddy!" from the direction of the lake. It was Kate, and she and her brother were paddling like pros out on the water. Both were obediently wearing their life jackets, and he waved at them. It is remarkable how a seemingly insignificant action or event can change entire lives. Kate, lifting her paddle to wave back in response, lost her balance and tipped the canoe. There was a frozen look of terror on her face as almost in silence and slow motion it rolled over. Josh frantically leaned to try and balance, but it was too late, and he disappeared from sight in the midst of the splash. Mac was already headed for the water's edge, not intending to go in, but to be near when they bobbed up. Kate was up first, sputtering and crying, but there was no sign of Josh. Then, suddenly, an eruption of water and legs, and Mac knew instantly that something was terribly wrong. To his amazement, all the instincts he had honed as a teenage lifeguard came roaring back. In a matter of seconds, he hit the water, shoes and shirt off. He didn't even notice the icy shock as he began racing the 50 feet out toward the overturned canoe, ignoring for the moment the terrified sobbing of his daughter. She was safe. His primary focus was Josh. Taking a deep breath, he dove under. The water, in spite of all the churning, was still fairly clear, with visibility about 3 feet. He found Josh quickly, and also discovered why he was in trouble. One of the straps on his life vest had gotten tangled in the canoe webbing. Try as he might, he couldn't yank it free either, so he tried to signal Josh to push himself deeper inside the canoe, where breathable air was trapped. But the poor boy was panicking, straining against the strap that was keeping him caught under the canoe rim and underwater. Mac surfaced, yelled at Kate to swim to shore, gulped whatever he could, and went under a second time. By his third dive, and knowing time was running out, Mac realized that he could either keep trying to free Josh from the vest or flip the canoe. Since Josh, in his panic, was not letting anyone near him, Mac chose the latter. Whether it was God and angels or God and adrenaline, he would never know for sure. But on only his second attempt, he succeeded in rolling the canoe over, freeing Josh from his tether. The jacket, finally able to do what it was designed for, now kept the boy's face above water. Mac surfaced behind Josh, who now was limp and unconscious, blood oozing from a gash on his head where the canoe had banged him as Mac had righted it. He immediately began mouth-to-mouth on his son as best he could, while others, who had heard the commotion, arrived to pull him and the canoe with the attached vest toward the shallows. Oblivious to the shouts around him, as people barked instructions and questions, Mac focused on his task, his own panic building inside his chest. Just as his feet touched solid ground, Josh began to cough and throw up water and breakfast. A huge cheer erupted from everyone gathered, but Mac couldn't care less. Overwhelmed with relief and the adrenaline rush of a narrow escape, he began to cry. And then suddenly, Kate was sobbing with her arms around his neck, and everyone was laughing and crying and hugging. Somehow they all made it to shore, Among those who had been drawn to the scene by the panic and noise were Jesse Madison and Emil Doucette. Through the mayhem of cheers and relief, Mac could hear Emil's voice, like the repetitious chant of a rosary, whispering again and again, "I am so sorry. I am so sorry. I am so sorry." It was his canoe. It could have been his children. Mac found him, wrapped his arms around the younger man, and emphasized strongly in his ear, "Stop it. This wasn't your fault, and everyone's okay." Emil began to sob, emotion suddenly freed from behind a dam of pent-up guilt and fear. A potential crisis had been averted, or so Mac thought. The Great Sadness. Sadness is a wall between two gardens. Khalil Gibran. Mac stood on the shore, doubled over and still trying to catch his breath. It took a few minutes before he even thought about Missy. Remembering that she had been coloring in her book at the table, he walked up the bank to where he could see the campsite, but there was no sign of her. His pace quickened as he hurried to the tent trailer, calling her name as calmly as he could manage. No response. She was not there. Even though his heart skipped a beat, he rationalized that in the confusion someone had seen to her, probably Sarah Madison or Vicky Doucette or one of the older kids. Not wanting to appear over-anxious or panicky, he found and soberly informed his two new friends that he couldn't find Missy and asked if they would each check with their families. Both quickly headed off to their respective campsites. Jesse returned first to announce that Sarah had not seen Missy at all that morning. He and Mac then headed for the Doucette site, but before they reached it, Emil came hurrying toward them, a look of apprehension written clearly on his face. "No one has seen Missy today, and we don't know where Amber is either. Maybe they're together." "I'm sure that's it. Where do you think they might be?" "Well, why don't we check the bathrooms and showers?" "Good idea. I'll check the one nearest our site, the one my kids use. Why don't you and Emil check the one between your sites?" They nodded, and Mac headed at a slow trot toward the closest showers, noticing for the first time that he was barefoot and shirtless. "What a sight I must be," he thought, and probably would have chuckled if his mind wasn't so focused on Missy. Arriving at the restrooms, he asked a teenager emerging from the woman's section if she had seen a little girl in a red dress inside, or maybe two girls. She told him that she hadn't noticed, but would look again. In less than a minute, she was back, shaking her head. "Thank you, anyway." Mac headed around the back of the building where the showers were located. As he rounded the corner, he began calling loudly for Missy. Mac could hear water running, but no one responded. Wondering if Missy might be in one of the showers, he began pounding on each until he got a response. He succeeded only in severely scaring a poor elderly lady when his door banging accidentally opened her shower stall. She shrieked, and Mac, with profuse apologies, quickly shut the door and hurried on to the next one. Six shower stalls. And no Missy. He checked the men's toilet stalls and showers, trying not to think about why he would even bother looking there. She was nowhere. And he jogged back towards Emil's, unable to pray anything except, "Oh, God, help me find her. Oh, God, please, help me find her." When she saw him, Vicky rushed to meet him. She'd been trying not to cry, but couldn't help it as they embraced. Suddenly, Mac desperately wanted Nan to be there. She would know what to do, at least what the right thing was. He felt so lost.
"Sarah has Josh and Kate back at your campsite, so don't worry about them."
"Oh, God, what kind of a father am I?"
Mac had totally forgotten about his other two. Although he was relieved that Sarah had them, he now wished even more that Nan were here. Just then, Emil and Jesse burst into camp, Emil appearing relieved, and Jesse looking as tense as a wound-up spring.
"We found her!"
exclaimed Emil, his face lighting up, then turning somber as he realized what he had implied.
"I mean, we found Amber. She just came back from taking a shower at this other place that still had hot water. She said she told her mom, but Vicky probably didn't hear her,
but we didn't find Missy."
Amber hasn't seen her today either.
Emil, all business now, took charge.
Mac, we need to contact the campground authorities immediately and get the word out to find Missy. Maybe in the ruckus and excitement she got scared and confused and just wandered away and got lost. Or maybe she was trying to find us and took a wrong turn. Do you have a picture of her? Maybe there's a copy machine at the office and we could make a few copies and save some time.
Yeah, I have a snapshot of her in my wallet.
He reached for his back pocket and for a second panicked as he found nothing there. The thought flashed through his mind of his wallet sitting at the bottom of Wallowa Lake, and then he remembered that it was still in his van after yesterday's trip up the tram. The three headed back to Mac's site. Jesse ran ahead to let Sarah know that Amber was safe, but that Missy's whereabouts were still unknown. Arriving at camp, Mac hugged and encouraged Josh and Kate as best he could, trying to appear calm for their sakes. Changing out of his wet clothes, he threw on a T-shirt and jeans, some clean, dry socks, and a pair of running shoes. Sarah promised that she and Vicky would keep his older two with them and whispered that she was praying for him and Missy. Mac gave her a quick hug and thanked her, and after kissing his children, joined the other two men as together they jogged toward the campground office. Word of the water rescue had reached the little two-room camp headquarters ahead of them, and everyone there was in high spirits. This changed quickly as the three took turns explaining Missy's disappearance. Fortunately, the office had a photocopier, and Mac enlarged half a dozen pictures of Missy, handing them around. The Wallowa Lake campground has 215 sites divided into five loops and three group areas. The young assistant manager, Jeremy Bellamy, volunteered to help canvas, so they divided the camp into four areas and each headed out, armed with a map, Missy's picture, and an office walkie-talkie. One assistant with a walkie-talkie also went back to Mac's site to report in if Missy turned up there. It was slow, methodical work, much too slow for Mac, but he knew that this was the most logical way to find her if she was still on the campgrounds. As he walked between tents and trailers, he was praying and promising. He knew in his heart that promising things to God was rather dumb and irrational, but he couldn't help it. He was desperate to get Missy back, and surely God knew where she was. Many campers were either not at their sites or in the final stages of packing up to head home. No one, he asked, had seen Missy or anyone looking like her. Periodically, the search parties checked in with the office to get an update on the progress, if any, that each was making. Nothing at all, until almost 2 in the afternoon. Mac was finishing his section when the call came in on the walkie-talkies. Jeremy, who had taken the area nearest the entrance, thought he had something. Emil instructed them to put a mark on their maps showing where each had left off, and then he gave them the site number where Jeremy had called from. Mac was the last to arrive, and he walked in on an intense conversation involving Emil, Jeremy, and a third young man that Mac did not recognize. Emil quickly brought Mac up to speed, introducing him to Virgil Thomas, a city boy from California, who had been camping all summer in the area with some buddies. Virgil and his friends had crashed after partying late into the night, and he had been the only one up who saw an old military green truck heading out the entrance and down the road towards Joseph. "About what time was that?"
"Like I told him," Virgil pointed his thumb at Jeremy. "It was before noon. I'm not sure how much before noon, though. I was kind of hungover, and we really haven't been paying much attention to clocks since we got here."
Mac pushed the picture of Missy in front of the young man. "Do you think you saw her?" Virgil looked at the photo.
"When the other fella first showed me that picture, she didn't look familiar, but then when he said that she was wearing a bright red dress, I remembered that the little girl in the green truck was wearing red, and she was either laughing or bellering. I couldn't really tell. And then it looked like the guy slapped her or pushed her down. But I suppose he could have been just playing, too."
Mac felt paralyzed. The information was overwhelming to him, but unfortunately, it was the only thing they had heard that made any sense. It explained why they had found no trace of Missy, but everything in him didn't want it to be true. He turned and started to run toward the office, but he was halted by Emil's voice.
"Mac, stop! We've already radioed the office and contacted the sheriff in Joseph. They're sending someone here right away and are putting out an APB on the truck."
As he finished speaking, as if on cue, two patrol cars pulled into the campgrounds. The first headed directly for the office, while the other turned into the section where they all stood waiting. Mac waved the officer down and hurried to meet him as he emerged from his vehicle. A young man, who looked to be in his late 20s, introduced himself as Officer Dalton and began taking their statements. The next hours saw a massive escalation in response to Missy's disappearance. An all-points bulletin was sent out as far west as Portland, east to Boise, Idaho, and north to Spokane, Washington. Police officers in Joseph set up a roadblock on the Imnaha Highway, which led out of Joseph and deeper into the Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area. If the child stealer had taken Missy up the Imnaha, only one of many directions he could have gone, the police figured they could get pertinent information by questioning those coming out. Their resources were limited, and rangers in the area were also contacted to be on the lookout. The Phillips campsite was cordoned off as a crime scene, and everyone in the vicinity was questioned. Virgil offered as much detail as he could about the truck and its occupants, and the resulting description was flashed out to all relevant agencies. The FBI field offices in Portland, Seattle, and Denver were put on notice. Nan had been called and was on her way, being driven by her best friend, Mary Ann. Even tracking dogs were brought in, but Missy's trail ended in the nearby parking lot, increasing the likelihood that Virgil's story was accurate. After forensic specialists had combed through his campsite, Officer Dalton asked Mac to re-enter the area and carefully look to see if anything was out of place or different than he remembered. Although already exhausted by the emotions of the day, Mac was desperate to do anything to help and deliberately focused his mind to try and remember whatever he could about the morning. Cautiously, so as not to disturb anything, he retraced his steps. What he would give for a do-over. A chance to have this day start from the beginning. Even if he burned his fingers and dropped the pancake batter all over again. If only he could take it back. Again, he turned back to his assigned task. But nothing seemed to be different than what he remembered. Nothing had changed. He came to the table where Missy had been busy. The book was open to the page she had been coloring, a half-finished picture of the Multnomah Indian princess. The crayons were also there, although Missy's favorite color, red, was missing. He began to look around on the ground to see where it might have fallen. "If you're looking for the red crayon, we found it over there, by the tree." Dalton pointed toward the parking lot. "She probably dropped it when she was struggling with..."
"How can you tell she was struggling?"
The officer hesitated, but then spoke, almost reluctantly. "We found one of her shoes near there in the bushes where it was probably kicked off. You weren't here at the time, so we asked your son to identify it." The image of his daughter fighting off some perverted monster was like a fist to the stomach. Almost succumbing to the sudden blackness that threatened to smother him, Mac leaned on the table to keep from passing out or throwing up. It was then that he noticed a ladybug pin sticking in the coloring book. He snapped to awareness as if someone had opened smelling salts under his nose.
"Whose is that?"
Mac pointed to the pin.
"Whose is what?"
"This ladybug pin. Who put that there?"
"We just assumed it was Missy's. Are you telling me that pin was not there this morning?"
"I'm positive. She doesn't own anything like that. I'm absolutely positive that it was not here this morning."
Officer Dalton was already on his radio, and within minutes, forensics was back and had taken the pin into custody. Dalton took Mac aside and explained.
"If what you say is correct,
then we have to assume that Missy's assailant left it here on purpose. Mr. Phillips, this could be good news or bad."
"I don't understand."
The officer again hesitated, trying to decide whether he should tell Mac what he was thinking. He searched for the right words.
"Well, the good news is that we might get some evidence off of it. It's the only thing we have so far linking him to the scene."
"And the bad news?" Mac held his breath.
"Well, the bad news, and I'm not saying that this is the case here, but guys who leave something like this usually have a purpose in leaving it, and it usually means that they have done this before."
"What are you saying? That this guy is some kind of serial killer? Is this some sort of mark that he leaves behind to identify himself? Like he's marking his territory or something?" Mac was getting angry, and it was evident by the look on Dalton's face that he was sorry for even mentioning it. But before Mac could blow, Dalton received an incoming call on his belt radio patching him through to the FBI field office in Portland, Oregon. Mac refused to leave and listened as a woman identified herself as a special agent. She asked Dalton to describe the pin in detail. Mac followed the officer to where the forensic team had set up a work area. The pin was secured inside a Ziploc bag, and standing just behind the group, he eavesdropped as Dalton described it as best he could.
It's a ladybug stick pin that was stuck through some pages of a coloring book, like one of those pins a woman would wear on her lapel, I think. Please describe the colors and number of dots on the ladybug.
Well, let's see. Dalton put his eyes almost up to the pouch.
The head is black with ladybug head, and the body is red with black edges and divisions. There are two black dots on the left side of the body as you look down from above, with the head at the top. Does that make sense?
Perfectly. Please go on.
And on the right side of the ladybug, there are three dots, so five in all.
There was a pause.
Are you sure there are five dots?
Yes, ma'am, there are five dots. He looked up and saw Mac, who had moved to the other side to see better, made eye contact and shrugged his shoulders as if to indicate, who cares how many dots?
Okay now, Officer Dabney?
Dalton, ma'am. Tommy Dalton. He looked up at Mac again and rolled his eyes.
Sorry, Officer Dalton. Would you please turn over the pin and tell me what is on the bottom or underside of the ladybug?
Dalton turned the pouch over and looked carefully.
There is something here engraved on the bottom, Special Agent, I didn't get your name exactly. Wachowski, spelled just like it sounds. Is it some letters or numbers?
Well, let me see.
Yeah, I think you're right. It looks like some kind of model number, CK146, I believe. Yeah, Charlie, Kilo, 146. It's tough to make out through the baggie.
There was silence on the other end. Mac whispered to Dalton,
"Ask her why or what that means."
Dalton hesitated and then complied. Again, there was an extended silence on the other end.
Wachowski, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Dalton, are you someplace private where you can talk?
Mac nodded with exaggeration, and Dalton got the message.
Hold on a sec.
He put down the pouch with the pin and moved outside the area, allowing Mac to follow. Dalton was already way beyond protocol with him anyway.
Yep, I am now. So tell me, what's the scoop on this ladybug?
We've been trying to catch this guy for almost 4 years, tracking him across more than 9 states now. He's been continually moving west. He's been nicknamed the Little Lady Killer, but we've never released the ladybug detail to the press or anyone else, so please keep that on the down low. We believe he's responsible for abducting and killing at least 4 children so far, all girls, all under the age of 10. Each time he adds a dot to the ladybug, so this would be number 5. He always leaves the same pin somewhere at the kidnap scene, all with the same model number, like he bought a box of them, but we've had no luck tracking down where they originally came from. We haven't found one of the bodies of any of those 4 little girls. And although forensics has come up with nothing, we have good reason to believe that none of the girls have survived. Every crime has taken place at or near a camping area with a state park or reserve close by. The perpetrator seems to be an expert woodsman and mountaineer. In every case, he's left us absolutely nothing, except the pin.
What about the car? We have a pretty good description of the green truck he left in.
Oh, you'll probably find it, all right. If this is our guy, it will have been stolen a day or two ago, repainted, full of outdoor gear, and it will be wiped clean.
As he listened to Dalton's conversation with Special Agent Wachowski, Mac felt the last of his hope draining away. He slumped to the ground and buried his face in his hands. Was there ever a man as tired as he was at this moment? For the first time since Missy's disappearance, he allowed himself to consider the range of horrendous possibilities, and once it started, he couldn't stop. The imaginations of good and evil all mixed up together in a soundless but terrifying parade. Even when he tried to shake free of the images, he couldn't. Some were horrible, ghastly snapshots of torture and pain, of monsters and demons of the deepest dark with barbed wire fingers and razor touches, of Missy screaming for her daddy, and no one answering. And mixed throughout these horrors were flashes of other memories. The toddler with her Missy sippy cup, as they had called it. The 2-year-old,
drunk from eating too much chocolate cake, and the one image so recently made as she fell asleep safely in her daddy's arms. Unyielding images. What would he say at her funeral? What could he possibly say to Nan? How could this have happened? God, how could this happen? A few hours later, Mac and his two children drove to the hotel in Joseph that had become the staging grounds for the growing search. The proprietors had kindly offered them a complimentary room, and as he moved a few of his things into it, his exhaustion began to get the better of him. He had gratefully accepted Officer Dalton's offer to take his children down to a local diner for some food, and now sitting down on the edge of the bed, he was swept helplessly away in the unrelenting and merciless grip of growing despair, slowly rocking back and forth. Soul-shredding sobs and groans clawed to the surface from the core of his being, and that is how Nan found him. Two broken lovers, they held each other and wept, as Mac poured out his sorrow, and Nan tried to hold him in one piece. That night, Mac slept in fits and starts as the images continued to pound him, like relentless waves on a rocky shore. Finally, he gave up, just before the sun began to issue hints of its arrival. He hardly noticed. In one day, he had spent a year's worth of emotions, and now he felt numb, adrift in a suddenly meaningless world that felt like it would be forever gray. After considerable protest from Nan, they agreed it would be best for her to head home with Josh and Kate. Mac would remain to help in any way he could, and to be close, just in case. He simply couldn't leave, not when she might still be out there needing him. Word had quickly spread, and friends arrived to help him pack up the site and cart everything back to Portland. His boss called, offering any support he could, and encouraging Mac to stay as long as he needed. Everyone they knew was praying. Reporters with their photographers in tow began showing up during the morning. Mac didn't want to face them or their cameras, but after some coaching, he spent time answering their questions in the parking lot, knowing the exposure could go a long way to help in the search for Missy. He had kept quiet about Officer Dalton overstepping his protocol, and Dalton returned the favor by keeping him inside the information loop. Jesse and Sarah, willing to do anything, made themselves constantly available to the family and friends who came to help. They lifted the huge burden of communication with the public from both Nan and Mac, and seemed to be everywhere as they skillfully wove some threads of peace into the turbulence of emotions. Emil Doucette's parents arrived after driving all the way from Denver to help Vicky and the kids get home safely. Emil, with the blessing of his superiors, had decided to stay behind to do what he could with the Park Service to help Mac stay informed on that side of things. Nan, who had bonded quickly with both Sarah and Vicky, had distracted herself by helping with little JJ, and then getting her own children ready for their trip back to Portland. And when she broke down, as she frequently did, Vicky or Sarah was always there to weep and pray with her. When it became clear that the need for their assistance was winding down, the Madisons packed up their own site and then came by for a teary farewell before heading north. As Jesse gave Mac a long hug, he whispered that they would see each other again, and that he would be in prayer for all of them. Sarah, tears rolling down her cheeks, simply kissed Mac on the forehead, and then held on to Nan, who again broke into sobs and moans. Sarah sang something, words Mac couldn't quite hear, but it calmed his wife until she was steady enough to let Sarah go. Mac couldn't even bear to watch as the couple finally walked away. As the Doucettes readied to go, Mac took a minute to thank Amber and Emmy for comforting and reaching out to his own, especially when he couldn't. Josh cried his goodbyes. He wasn't brave anymore, at least not today. Kate, on the other hand, had become a rock, busying herself, making sure that everyone had everyone else's addresses and emails. Vicky's world had been shaken by the events, and now she had to be almost pried from Nan, as her own grief threatened to sweep her away. Nan held her, stroking her hair and whispering prayers into her ear, until she was settled enough to walk to the waiting car. By noon, all of the families were on the road. Marianne drove Nan and the kids home, where family would be waiting to care for and comfort them. Mac and Emil joined Officer Dalton, who was now just Tommy, and headed into Joseph in Tommy's patrol car. There they grabbed sandwiches, which were barely touched, and then drove to the police station. Tommy Dalton was the father of two daughters himself, his oldest being only five, so it was easy to see that this case struck a particular nerve with him. He extended every kindness and courtesy he could to his new friends, especially Mac. Now came the hardest part, waiting. Mac felt like he was moving in slow motion inside the eye of a hurricane of activity happening all around him. Reports filtered in from everywhere. Even Emil was busy networking with the people and professionals he knew. The FBI entourage arrived mid-afternoon from field offices in three cities. It was clear from the start that the person in charge was Special Agent Wachowski, a small, slim woman who was all fire and motion, and to whom Mac took an instant liking. She publicly returned the favor. And from that moment on, no one questioned his presence at even the most intimate of conversations or debriefings. After setting up their command center at the hotel, the FBI asked Mac to come in for a formal interview, something they insisted was routine in these kinds of circumstances. Agent Wachowski rose from behind the desk she was working at and held out her hand. As he reached for the handshake, she clasped both her hands around his and smiled grimly. "Mr. Phillips, I apologize I haven't been able to spend much time with you so far. We've been frantically busy setting up communications with all the law enforcement and other agencies involved in trying to get Missy back safely. I'm so sorry that we have to meet under such conditions." Mac believed her. "Mac. I beg your pardon? Mac, please. Call me Mac." "Well, Mac, then please call me Sam. Short for Samantha. But I grew up kind of a tomboy and beat up the kids who would dare call me Samantha to my face." Mac couldn't help but smile, relaxing a little into the chair as he watched her quickly sort through a couple of folders full of papers. "Mac, are you up for a few questions?" she asked without looking up. "I'll do my best." He was grateful for the opportunity to do anything. "Good. I won't make you walk through all the details again. I have the reports on everything that you told the others, but I have a couple of important things to go over with you." She looked up, making eye contact. "Anything I can do to help. I'm feeling very useless at the moment." "Mac, I understand how you feel, but your presence here is important, and believe me, there is not a person here who doesn't care about your Missy. We will do everything in our power to get her back safely." "Thank you," was all Mac could say, and he looked down at the floor. Emotion seemed so near the surface, and even the least bit of kindness seemed to poke holes in his reserve. "Okay, now, I've had a good off-the-record talk with your friend, Officer Tommy, and he filled me in on everything that you and he have talked about, so don't feel like you have to protect his butt. He's all right in my book." Mac looked up and nodded and smiled again at her. "So, have you noticed anyone strange around your family these past few days?" Mac was surprised and sat back in his chair.
"You mean he's been stalking us?"
"No, he seems to choose his victims at random, though they were all about the age of your daughter with similar hair color. We think he spots them a day or two before and waits and watches from nearby for an opportune moment. Have you seen anyone unusual or out of place near the lake, perhaps near the bathrooms?" Mac recoiled at the thought of his children being watched, being targets. He tried to think past his own imagination, but came up blank.
"I'm sorry, not that I can remember.
Did you stop anywhere on your way to the campgrounds or notice anyone strange when you were hiking or sightseeing in the area?"
"We stopped at Multnomah Falls on the way here, and we've been all over the area the past 3 days. But I don't recall seeing anyone who looked out of the ordinary."
"Who would have thought?" "Exactly, Max, so don't beat yourself up. Something may come to mind later. No matter how small or irrelevant it might seem, please, let us know. What about a green military truck? Have you noticed anything like that around while you were here?"
Mac raked his memory. "I really can't remember seeing anything like it."
Special Agent Wachowski continued to question Mac for the next 15 minutes, but could not jar his memory enough to provide anything helpful. She finally closed her notebook and stood, extending her hand.
"Mac, again,
I am so sorry about Missy. If anything breaks, I will personally let you know the minute it happens.
At 5 p.m., the first promising report finally came in from the Imnaha roadblock. As she had promised, Agent Wachowski immediately sought out Mac and filled him in on the details. Two couples had encountered a green, military-looking truck matching the description of the vehicle everyone was searching for. They had been exploring some old Nez Perce sites off of National Forest 4260 in one of the more remote areas of the National Reserve, and on their way out, they had come face-to-face with the vehicle just south of the junction where NF-4260 and NF-250 split. Because that section of road was basically one lane, they had to back up to a safe place to allow the truck to pass. They noted that the pickup had a number of gas cans in the back, plus a fair amount of camping gear. The odd part was that the man had bent over toward his passenger side as if looking for something on the floor, pulled his hat down low, and wore a big coat in the heat of the day, almost as if he were afraid of them. They had just laughed it off as one of those militia freaks. The instant the report was announced to the group, tensions in the station increased. Tommy came over to let Mac know that, unfortunately, everything he had learned so far fit the little lady killer's M.O., to head for remote areas out of which he could eventually hike. It was obvious that he knew where he was going, as the locale where he had been spotted was well off the beaten path. Unlucky for him that someone else had been so far out there as well. With evening quickly approaching, an intense discussion began regarding the efficacy of immediate pursuit or holding off until daybreak. Regardless of their point of view, it seemed that everyone who spoke was deeply affected by the situation. Something in the heart of most human beings simply cannot abide pain inflicted on the innocent, especially children. Even broken men serving in the worst correctional facilities will often first take out their own rage on those who have caused suffering to children. Even in such a world of relative morality, causing harm to a child is still considered absolutely wrong, period. Standing near the back of the room, Mac listened impatiently to what seemed like time-wasting bickering. He was almost ready to kidnap Tommy if he had to and go after the guy himself. It felt like every second counted. Although it certainly felt longer to Mac, the various departments and personalities agreed quickly and unanimously to set out in pursuit just as soon as a few arrangements could be made. Although there weren't many ways to drive out of the area, and roadblocks were being set up immediately to prevent this, there was a very real concern that a skilled hiker could pass undetected into the Idaho wilderness to the east or Washington State to the north. While officials in the towns of Lewiston, Idaho, and Clarkston, Washington, were being contacted and notified of the situation, Mac quickly called Nan to give her an update, and then left with Tommy. By now, he had only one prayer left.
"Dear God, please, 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 take care of my Missy. I just can't right now."
Tears traced their way down his cheeks, and then spilled off onto his shirt. By 7:30 p.m., the convoy of patrol cars, FBI SUVs, pickups with dogs in kennels, and some ranger vehicles headed up the Imnaha Highway. Instead of turning east onto the Wallowa Mountain Road, which would have taken them directly into the National Reserve, they stayed on the Imnaha and headed north. Eventually, they took the lower Imnaha Road and finally Dugbar Road into the reserve. Mac was glad he was traveling with someone who knew the area. It seemed at times that Dugbar Road went in all directions simultaneously. It was almost as if whoever had named these roads had run out of ideas, or simply got tired or drunk and began naming everything Dugbar just so he could go home. The roads, with frequent narrow switchbacks edging steep drop-offs, became even more treacherous in the pitch dark of night. Progress slowed to a crawl. Finally, they passed the point where the green pickup had last been seen, and a mile later came to the junction where NF-4260 went farther north-northeast and NF-250 headed southeast. There, as planned, the caravan split into two, with a small group heading north up the 4260 with Special Agent Wachowski, while the rest, including Mac, Emil, and Tommy, went southeast on the 250. A few difficult miles later, this larger group split again, Tommy and a dog truck continuing down the 250 where, according to the maps, the road would end, and the rest taking the more easterly route,
through the park on NF 4240 down toward the Temperance Creek area. At this point, all search efforts slowed even more. The trackers were now on foot and backed up by powerful floodlights while they looked for signs of recent activity on the roads, anything that might suggest the particular area they were examining was something other than a dead end. Almost 2 hours later, and moving at a snail's pace toward the end of 250, a call came into Dalton from Witkowski. Her team had caught a break. About 10 miles from the junction where they had separated, an old unnamed road left the 4260 and headed straight north for almost 2 miles. It was barely visible and deeply potted. They would either have missed it entirely or ignored it, except that one of the trackers had flashed his floodlight off a hubcap less than 50 feet from the main road. Out of curiosity, he retrieved it, and under the covering of road dust, found it splattered with specks of green paint. The hubcap had probably been lost when the truck had tussled with one of the many deep potholes strewn in that direction. Tommy's group immediately turned back the way they had come. Mac didn't want to let himself begin to hope that perhaps, by some miracle, Missy might still be alive, especially when everything he knew told him otherwise. 20 minutes later, another call from Witkowski, this time to tell them they had found the truck. Choppers and search planes would never have seen it from the sky, covered as it was under a carefully built lean-to of limbs and brush. It took Mac's crew almost 3 hours to reach the first team, and by then it was all over. The dogs had done the rest, uncovering a descending game trail that led more than a mile into a small, hidden valley. There they found a run-down little shack near the edge of a pristine lake barely half a mile across, fed by a cascading creek 100 yards away. A century or so earlier, this had probably been a settler's home. It had 2 good-sized rooms, enough to house a small family. Since that time, it had most likely served as an occasional hunter's or poacher's cabin. By the time Mac and his friends arrived, the sky was beginning to show the grays of pre-dawn. A base camp had been set up well away from the battered little cabin in order to preserve the crime scene. The moment Witkowski's group had found the place, dog trackers had been sent out in different directions to try and locate a scent. Occasionally, the baying indicated that they had found something, only to have it disappear again. Now they were all returning to regroup and plan the day's strategy. Special Agent Samantha Witkowski was sitting at a card table doing some map work and drinking a large, dripping bottle of water when Mac walked up. She offered him a grim smile, which he didn't return, and an extra bottle, which he accepted. Her eyes were sad and tender, but her words were all business. "Hey, Mac, why don't you pull up a chair?" Mac didn't want to sit down. He needed to do something to stop his stomach from churning. Sensing trouble, he stood and waited for her to continue. "Mac, we found something, but it's not good news." He fumbled for the right words. "Did you find Missy?" It was the question that he didn't want to hear the answer to, but desperately needed to know. "No, we didn't find her." Sam paused and started to stand up. "But I do need you to come and identify something we found down in that old shack. I need to know if it was, if it is hers." His gaze went to the ground. He felt a million years old, almost wishing he could somehow turn himself into a big, unfeeling rock. Mac, I'm so sorry. Look, we can do this later if you like. I just thought..." He couldn't look at her, and even found it difficult to come up with words that he could speak without falling apart. He could feel the dam about to burst again. "Let's do it now. I want to know everything there is to know." Witkowski must have signaled the others, because although Mac didn't hear anything, he suddenly felt Emil and Tommy each take one of his arms as they turned and followed the special agent down the short path to the shack. 3 grown men, arms locked in some special grace of solidarity, walking together, each one toward his own worst nightmare. A member of the forensic team opened the door of the shack to let them in. Generator-powered lighting illuminated every part of the main room. Shelving lined the walls, an old table, a few chairs, and an old sofa that someone had hauled in with no little effort. Mac immediately saw what he had come to identify, and, turning, crumpled into the arms of his 2 friends and began to weep uncontrollably. On the floor by the fireplace lay Missy's torn and blood-soaked red dress. For Mac, the next few days and weeks became an emotion-numbing blur of interviews with law enforcement and the press, followed by a memorial service for Missy with a small, empty coffin and an endless sea of faces, all sad as they paraded by, no one knowing what to say. Sometime during the weeks that followed, Mac began the slow and painful merging back into everyday life. The little lady killer, it seemed, was credited with taking his fifth victim, Melissa Ann Phillips. As was true in the other four cases, authorities never recovered Missy's body, even though search teams had scoured the forest around the shack for days after its discovery. As in every other instance, the killer had left no fingerprints and no DNA. He'd left no useful evidence anywhere, only the pin. It was as if the man were a ghost. At some point in the process, Mac attempted to emerge from his own pain and grief, at least with his family. They had lost a sister and daughter, but it would be wrong for them to lose a father and husband as well. Although no one involved was left unmarked by the tragedy, Kate seemed to have been affected the most, disappearing into a shell, like a turtle protecting its soft underbelly from anything potentially dangerous. It seemed that she would only poke her head out when she felt fully safe, which was becoming less and less often. Mac and Nan both worried increasingly about her, but couldn't seem to find the right words to penetrate the fortress she was building around her heart. Attempts at conversation would turn into one-way monologues, with sounds bouncing off her stone visage. It was as if something had died inside her, and now was slowly infecting her from the inside, spilling out occasionally in bitter words or emotionless silence. Josh fared much better, due in part to the long-distance relationship he had kept up with Amber. Email and the telephone gave him an outlet for his pain, and she had given him the time and space to grieve. He was also preparing to graduate from high school with all the distractions that his senior year provided. The great sadness had descended, and in differing degrees cloaked everyone whose lives had touched Missy's. Mac and Nan weathered the storm of loss together with reasonable success, and in some ways were closer for it. Nan had made it clear from the start, and repeatedly, that she did not blame Mac in any way for what happened. Understandably, it took Mac much longer to let himself off the hook, even a little bit. It is so easy to get sucked into the if-only game, and playing it is a short and slippery slide into despair. If only he had decided not to take the kids on that trip. If only he had said no when they asked to use the canoe. If only he had left the day before. If only. And then to have it all end with nothing. The fact that he was unable to bury Missy's body magnified his failure as her daddy. That she was still out there somewhere alone in the forest haunted him every day. Now, 3.5 years later, Missy was officially presumed to have been murdered. Life would never be normal again. Not that any time is really ever normal. It would be so empty without his Missy. The tragedy had also increased the rift in Mac's own relationship with God, but he ignored this growing sense of separation. Instead, he tried to embrace a stoic, unfeeling faith, and even though Mac found some comfort and peace in that, it didn't stop the nightmares where his feet were stuck in the mud and his soundless screams could not save his precious Missy. The bad dreams were becoming less frequent, and laughter and moments of joy were slowly returning, but he felt guilty about these. So when Mac received the note from Papa telling him to meet him back at the shack, it was no small event. Does God even write notes? And why the shack, the icon of his deepest pain? Certainly God would have better places to meet with him. A dark thought even crossed his mind that the killer could be taunting him or luring him away to leave the rest of his family unprotected. Maybe it was all just a cruel hoax. But then, why was it signed Papa? Try as he might, Mac could not escape the desperate possibility that the note just might be from God after all, even if the thought of God passing notes did not fit well with his theological training. In seminary, he'd been taught that God had completely stopped any overt communication with moderns, preferring to have them only listen to and follow sacred scripture, properly interpreted, of course. God's voice had been reduced to paper, and even that paper had to be moderated and deciphered by the proper authorities and intellects. It seemed that direct communication with God was something exclusively for the ancients and uncivilized, while educated Westerners' access to God was mediated and controlled by the intelligentsia. Nobody wanted God in a box, just in a book, especially an expensive one bound in leather with gilt edges. Or was that gilt, G-U-I-L-T, edges? The more Mac thought about it, the more confused and irritated he became. Who sent the damn note? Whether it was God or the killer or some prankster, what did it matter? Whichever way he looked at it, it felt like he was being toyed with. In any way, what good was following God at all? Look where it got him. But in spite of his anger and depression, Mac knew that he needed some answers. He realized he was stuck, and Sunday prayers and hymns weren't cutting it anymore, if they ever really had. Cloistered spirituality seemed to change nothing in the lives of the people he knew, except maybe Nan. But she was special. God might really love her. She wasn't a screw-up like him. He was sick of God and God's religion, sick of all the little religious social clubs that didn't seem to make any real difference or affect any real changes. Yes, Mac wanted more. And he was about to get much more than he bargained for. Guess who's coming to dinner? We routinely disqualify testimony that would plead for extenuation. That is, we are so persuaded of the rightness of our judgment as to invalidate evidence that does not confirm us in it. Nothing that deserves to be called truth could ever be arrived at by such means. Marilynne Robinson, The Death of Adam. There are times when you choose to believe something that would normally be considered absolutely irrational. It doesn't mean that it is actually irrational, but it surely is not rational. Perhaps there is supra-rationality, reason beyond the normal definitions of fact or data-based logic, something that only makes sense if you can see a bigger picture of reality. Maybe that is where faith fits in. Mac wasn't sure about a lot of things, but at some time in his heart and mind during the days following his tiff with the icy driveway, he became convinced that there were three plausible explanations for the note. It was either from God, as absurd as that sounded, a cruel joke, or something more sinister from Missy's killer. Regardless, the note dominated his thoughts every waking minute and his dreams at night. Secretly, he began to make plans to travel to the shack the following weekend. At first, he told no one, not even Nan. He had no reasonable defense in any exchange that would result after such a disclosure, and he was afraid that he might get locked up and the key thrown away. Anyway, he rationalized such a conversation would only bring more pain with no resolution. "I am keeping it to myself for Nan's sake," he told himself. Besides, acknowledging the note would mean admitting that he had kept secrets from her, secrets he still justified in his own mind. Sometimes honesty can be incredibly messy. Convinced of the rightness of his impending journey, Mac began to consider ways to get the family away from home for the weekend without rousing any suspicions. There was the slim possibility that the killer was trying to lure him out of town, leaving the family unprotected, and that was not acceptable. But he was stumped. Nan was too perceptive for him to show his hand in any way, and doing so would just lead to questions that he was not ready to answer. Fortunately for Mac, it was Nan herself who proffered a solution. She had been toying with the idea of visiting her sister and family up in the San Juan Islands, off the coast of Washington. Her brother-in-law was a child psychologist, and Nan thought that getting his insights on Kate's increasingly antisocial behavior might be very helpful, especially since neither she nor Mac were having any success getting through to her. When she brought up the possibility of the trip, Mac was almost too eager in his response. "Of course you are going." That was not the reply she had anticipated, and she gave him a quizzical look.
"I mean, I think that's a great idea. I will miss you all, of course, but I think I can survive alone for a couple days, and I have lots to do anyway."
She shrugged it off, perhaps grateful that the path for her to leave had opened so easily.
"I just think it would be good for Kate, especially, to get away for a few days."
He nodded in agreement. A quick call to Nan's sister, and their trip was set. The house soon became a whirlwind of activity. Josh and Kate were both delighted. This would extend their spring break for a week. They loved visiting their cousins and were an easy sell on the whole idea, not that they really had any choice in the matter. On the sly, Mac called up Willie and, while trying rather unsuccessfully to not divulge too much information, asked if he could borrow his friend's four-wheel drive Jeep. Since Nan was taking the van, he needed something better than his own little car to negotiate the pitted roads in the reserve, which would most likely still be buried in winter's grip. Mac's odd request predictably started a barrage of questions from Willie, questions that Mac tried to answer as evasively as he could. When Willie bluntly asked if Mac's intention was a trip to the shack, Mac told him that while he could not answer his questions at that moment, he would explain fully when Willie came over in the morning to exchange vehicles. Late Thursday afternoon, Mac saw Nan, Kate, and Josh off with hugs and kisses all around, and then he slowly began his own preparations for the long drive to northeastern Oregon, to the place of his nightmares.